Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, are there better ways to stop so many people from being evicted? Two U.S. senators think so. Democrats Kamala Harris and Cory Booker introduced bills this summer to address the high rate of eviction. But Congress is slow and the problem is growing. In 2016, more than 1 million households were evicted from the places they lived. Sociologist and author Matthew Desmond says the face of America's eviction epidemic belongs to mothers and children. So what can cities and states do? Most importantly, what works to keep more Americans in their homes? As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. If you or someone in your family has experienced eviction, what happened? Did you find help when you needed it? If you're a landlord who has had to evict people, I think your perspective would be valuable in the discussion, too. If you work in a field that tries to address the problem, talk to me about what makes a difference. So, beginning this conversation with a lot of different perspectives, someone who has experienced eviction, someone in your family, did you find help when you needed it? If you're a landlord, what does this look like to you? And if you work in the field, what do you know about what works? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Jesse McCoy is with us. He's an expert on eviction law and the supervising attorney at the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, and he joins us today from Durham, North Carolina. Jesse, welcome. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Brennan is with us. She's a senior policy associate for the Urban Institute, and she researches the issue. And she's with us from Washington. Maya, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Jesse, is Matthew Desmond, who has written a book about this and really opened our eyes to eviction, is he right when he talks about the face of eviction belonging to mothers and children? Is that mostly who's affected by this?
Absolutely. When I go to court and I litigate these cases, oftentimes you'll see courtrooms packed with black and brown faces, usually mothers, single mothers, who are being evicted just given the economic circumstances that they find themselves in.
So I know that you and your team at the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, you represent a number of people who are being evicted. I wondered if it's true that many of these people show up to court, if you're not there, with no legal representation. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. Even with our clinic and in North Carolina, specifically Durham County, where we operate, we're dealing with about 900 eviction filings per month. Our clinic has been able to handle about 50 of them, and that's pretty much filling us to capacity. So most of the people on the tenant side are largely unrepresented, unlike landlords who will almost always have an attorney.
Maya, that seems, as with, you know, much of our justice system, really unfair. What do you know about what happens if you're somebody on the verge of eviction, you show up in court, are you usually going to lose that case?
Most of the time, the tenant showing up in court without an attorney will lose the case. Most of the time what happens is that, now, I should say, eviction laws and the court process varies all across the country, sometimes even from county to county. But what we see is that a tenant goes into court without representation, and they may need to just settle that case right away, even if it means accepting a judgment that they don't think is valid, so that they can get out of the courtroom and get back to work and back to their life instead of spending their whole day there. Or they may just not know the affirmative defenses that are available to them.
What are the affirmative defenses?
Well, these really vary from place to place. I had worked as a hotline counselor answering questions of landlords and tenants all over the state of Maryland at one point. And there, if you go into court because you haven't paid your rent, you can bring up the property conditions. That's not something that's available in every place across the nation, but there may be other cases like that of affirmative defenses.
So I'm curious about this, Jesse. Let's say as a person who's on the verge of eviction, can you come in and say something about
yes, I've been paying rent, but now I've been unable to pay for the last 3 months. But look at the conditions in which I'm living, and the judge will consider that.
Well, absolutely. And not only that, the judges are supposed to consider any of the habitability concerns that someone expresses. The problem so often, though, is people have a tendency to overlook conditions-related issues going on in their place and focus myopically on the money that they need to remain in the unit.
I see.
And that creates a bigger issue, because if the eviction case is filed and you get before the judge and this is the first that you've reported of any habitability concern, it makes it very difficult for the court system to believe that these are legitimate interests.
So it is really important that if you're living in a place that is not up to codes or standards, that you raise these problems early on in your tenancy and continue to raise them, yes?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And half of our job is trying to connect people with the resources that are out here, because most counties have a county inspections department that will come and inspect your unit for free and provide you a courtesy copy of any violations of that county's code that you can use as evidence in court to suggest that the value of your unit isn't what the market rent is.
Call here from Lori in Invergrove Heights. Lori, it sounds like you've been through this. Is that right?
Yes, yes, I have.
Tell me what happened.
I after a divorce, I had full custody of my five children, and we moved into a house for our family. Mm-hmm. And there was domestic violence with one of the roommates, because I needed a roommate to share. And although the legislation in Minnesota has got help for renters in that situation during domestic violence, I couldn't get help from the county to help pay this rent. And at, you know, $1,500 a month, it was ridiculous. And although I was paying everything forward and ahead, the landlord was able to go to court and say, yep, she's like $20 behind every month. And they still put a UI forward. And even when I caught up, a sheriff showed up at our door and said, well, nope, the landlord said that it's not paid off. You need to leave. And we showed him documentation. It didn't matter. The landlord has the right, and you have to go back to court and show them beyond a reasonable doubt that, you know, they cashed the checks and that this rent was paid, which is pretty hard to do. And
I mean, it sounds that almost sounds like the burden was on you to come up with all this documentation to show that the landlord had been compensated. Lori, can you stay with me for just a minute?
Yes.
Maya, how common is that?
We hear fairly often about situations in which a renter is at the door of their home. The sheriff is there, and they're not able to prove sufficiently to the sheriff that things are resolved. And tenants are not accustomed to having to be tracking all of the tracking and retaining all of the documentation of the payments that have been made. You think you put your rent in the mail and that's enough, or you give the money to the landlord and that's going to be enough. But we do instead need to think constantly whether as renters or as landlords about document, document, document.
Lori, can I ask you if you were receiving compensation, you know, in the wake of the divorce from your husband for spousal, for child support?
Yeah, I was supposed to. I was supposed to, and he wasn't paying, and which, you know, I had documentation of that. Mm-hmm. I had went to the county and did emergency assistance, you know, trying to do every situation. Like I said, I had a roommate in there that had domestic violence. So I had an order for protection even to show that there's domestic violence and how this is going to impact, you know, financially, how it's going to impact our rent. And
right.
We still couldn't get assistance to be able to stay there.
Jesse, does this sound all too common?
It's quite common. And one of the concerns that I always have, even though I understand that different states have different laws, documentation does become increasingly important on the tenant side. Landlords oftentimes, just from the benefit of having a maintained ledger for any rental payments that they receive and for having access to that attorney for filings, mm-hmm. will oftentimes be able to be ahead of the curve when it comes to preserving documentation. And even I've even had situations where habitability concerns were addressed long ago, but because the landlord maintains the file and record of work orders that were requested and the tenant does not have access to it, it becomes very difficult to establish an initial contact point. What I would say for this particular situation, what it sounds like to me is the landlord took advantage of the benefits under the court system. Oftentimes in North Carolina, once the sheriff gets to your door, that case is long over. The case is really decided at the courthouse when that initial complaint is filed and you have a hearing. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate part of that is there are several things that happen to people in life that will not serve always as legal defenses in a court case. Particularly what you often hear is unexpected medical illness, job loss.
Right.
Things like that, that can just, you know, everybody being one paycheck away from absolute catastrophe. They present those issues in court and the magistrate or judge, depending on who's hearing the case, is going to say, well, unfortunately, I can't take that into consideration. He's saying that the payment wasn't made. But there are ways to get around that payment not being made, depending on everybody's particular facts and situation.
Lori, have you found, you know, safe and steady housing for you and your family?
I have a very close friend that's been able to house us. So, yeah, that was good.
And do you know where there are resources to help you when you're ready to find a place?
Yes, but now with a UI on my record,
right.
It is extremely hard to be able to get a place.
I was going to ask you about that, Jesse. What do you do if you have that on the record? Because I'm hearing from some people on Twitter who have had the same thing.
Absolutely. So we are we have put together a pilot program here with the express objective of reducing eviction judgments. And the reason we did that is because we were discovering that there were a number of collateral consequences that were running with people who had already had an eviction judgment obtained. The way the North Carolina system works, there were people who were even appealing their small claims decision to a district court judge, winning in district court, and that eviction is still being reported despite the fact they won. The burden is always put on the tenant to go back and fix. So one of the things that we've been successful in trying to get in, at least in our county, is to get judges to do what's called to vacate the small claims judgment so that that judgment comes off of the court record. This isn't something that has been adopted in a national capacity yet.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, because evictions are so unique to the state and particularly the county where the process is handled, this is something that we're trying to push and advocate for more places to do.
Sven says on Twitter, received an unlawful detainer after a work injury, which counts as an eviction on your record. I'm automatically rejected by any type of rental check. 43 and our apartment is in a family member's name. Maya, would you say that this is an important part of some kind of national legislation or states take this up to get these UIs off your record? Is this a priority, I guess I'm asking?
Yeah, sure. So determining what to do with all of the folks around a million a year who get an eviction judgment, and even people who just have an eviction filing, often landlords will just plain reject anyone who's ever been taken to court, no matter whether there was a judgment or not.
Wow.
Trying to figure out what to do to make sure that these people and families can have stable housing again is one of the most crucial underexplored policy questions. Often we think about how to prevent the eviction, but for all of the evictions that don't get prevented, we need to figure out how to make sure that households, especially knowing that these are often parents with children or single mothers with children, people who would experience a lot of vulnerability in sort of a shadow rental market,
We need to make sure that they can have an adequate and stable home again. So there are some ideas about how to solve that. Some of them involve things like creating a guarantee program where there's a special extra security deposit for landlords who are willing to take somebody who has an eviction on their record. Mm-hmm. There's also consideration about whether housing authorities and other housing assistance programs should overlook these evictions that often come as people are sitting on the waiting list for assistance for years. Or there are other sort of programs and ideas that may come a little bit earlier in the process. California, though, one of the things that they do is make sure that after a period of time, those cases, even the judgments, get sealed so that if you haven't had an eviction, for example, in the past 2 years, your eviction case would not be able to be found.
Nobody can go back and look at that record. Yeah.
Right.
Maya Brennan with us this morning from the Urban Institute, and Jesse McCoy with us from the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, where he and a team of student lawyers help represent people who are facing eviction. And that's what our conversation is about this morning. I'm sure you've read about the epidemic of eviction in this country. Our show is focused on what works to help keep more people in their homes, what to do if you have an eviction on your record, and what this means to experience it, which is why grateful for Lori to call in. If someone in your family has been through this or you've been through this, what happened? Did you turn somewhere for help? Did you get the help you needed? If you're a landlord, I recognize you have a perspective on this as well, and we're going to take some calls on that. And if you work in a field that tries to address the problem, what are you finding is effective? 651-227-6000. If you're anywhere in the region, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, where Cheryl says, my daughter has an eviction on her record that now prevents her and her child from being able to rent. Despite the fact that she paid her portion of the rent and gave notice she was leaving the child's daddy and moving out, her ex-boyfriend didn't pay his share, resulting in an eviction of both. To the phones to Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry.
Hi, I'm an attorney, and I've been working on landlord-tenant issues for about 35 years from mm-hmm. the tenant side, but I've also been a landlord, too. I can see both perspectives.
Okay.
I helped start clinics at the U and at the courthouse in Hennepin County to give advice and represent tenants. And a couple of things I wanted to mention on the expungement issue. Generally, tenants have to show that the landlord did something wrong in their case to get an expungement, as opposed to just that the tenant was on hard times, and that's because of a law that we have that requires that. So one thing we could do is change that law to make it easier to get an expungement when the tenant was just on hard times.
Okay.
Another problem is that these court records stay out there literally forever. They're starting to implement some systems to have older cases fall out of the system, but they're still out there, and tenant screening agencies on a weekly basis purchase with a contract a digital download of all the court files. And so those, you know, if there's an eviction case filed against you today, it's going to appear in their reports next week. And so something that kind of limits the amount of time that those cases are out there would be another thing. And a couple other things real quick, requiring some sort of pre-filing mediation before landlords file cases so mm-hmm. that issues could be resolved before they ever become court records.
Okay.
And lastly, a lot of tenants, poor tenants, have habitability problems. And if in Minnesota, if they withhold rent and the landlord files an eviction case and they don't hang on to every dime of it, they will not even get a chance to put on evidence of the habitability issue that could lead to a rent reduction. And so it's just really, if you withhold your rent, you have to hang on to every dime of it. And when you're really poor, that's hard to do. So
right.
There are a number of law changes we could do to kind of make the system more balanced.
Really, I'm really glad you heard the show, Larry, and you had a chance to call in. I'm going to ask Jesse about this pre-file mediation. Do any states do that, Jesse? Would that be helpful?
Well, right now, North Carolina does not currently have pre-filing mediation. I have heard of states that do. The way that the system works for us is part of our eviction diversion program is to act as mediators in a sense in connecting landlords and their concerns with tenants and their concerns. We discovered that the law in North Carolina is very adversarial. Mm. And for many different reasons, landlords will prefer to go to court and go ahead and file and remove someone through that process, as opposed to talking to them on a personal level to figure out what can be resolved. And when we talked to landlord groups, we found that that was given particular consideration to showing favoritism to one community of people versus another. They didn't want that connotation to come from their limited interactions. But through our program, they felt more open to be able to do that. So half of our job is reducing cases so that they don't go forward in court. In addition, that also saves the landlord the money that they would pay for an attorney and for the filing fees associated with it, as well as re-advertising fees. And on the tenant side, it maintains a continuous tenancy through whatever payment plan that we're able to arrange. It also allows us to effectually get a record of repairs that needs to be completed, so that the landlords will know what needs to be done and can make efforts to allocate the money they would have spent evicting to fixing what needs to be fixed.
Jesse, I have to say I was surprised when I read this report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition that 76% of people who are eligible for housing assistance don't get it. What's going on with that? Would that also help what we're talking about today?
So we've got a couple different levels when you're talking about housing assistance. Mm-hmm. So one is your traditional housing authority, which would have things like a housing choice voucher program. In our area, in our county alone, we have about 7,000 people on a 3-year wait list for a housing choice voucher.
Wow.
The problem is our market right now is also very hot. So even people who have successfully navigated the list to get a housing choice voucher are now having those vouchers denied because the landlords don't need to operate using those vouchers anymore. Mm. The second level of housing assistance would be for your emergency rental assistance programs. Mm-hmm. Those are usually guided through the County Department of Social Services. And there are a number of rules and regulations imposed both on the federal government for that funding, as well as the county government on that funding. One such rule is you cannot have received assistance from that program within the past 12 months. So if there's somebody who used the benefit of the program 11 months ago, they're not going to qualify for it now. The second problem for that is there's oftentimes what we call a sustainability index. So basically, they have to prove to the county Department of Social Services that once they receive this one-time cash injection, they'll be able to sustain the payments moving forward. And as you can imagine, when there's an unexpected illness or when there's a job loss, there's no way to necessarily convey you'll be able to sustain the rent. So oftentimes people are weeded out because of that or because of any other eligibility criteria based on the specific housing assistance program they're seeking.
Joshua says on Twitter, I was evicted in 2011 after losing my job. I had to rent from family or friends basically since then. Makes one unrentable and dropped credit score. Still on my record as a judgment. It isn't removed for up to 7 years from the credit report and 10 years as public records. To the phones to Jim in Pequot Lakes. Jim, you're a landlord. Is that right?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask you what you're thinking as you hear the conversation develop. I'm glad you called.
Well, I've learned the hard way that, unbeknownst to most people, that the rules, at least in my estimation, are stacked against the landlord as far as recovering what they've lost. I learned that it was easier for me, rather than going through the eviction process, to just tell people, you know, pay me what you owe me, be out in 30 days, and I'll let you out of the lease, because I end up with less damage that way. Then the people aren't embarrassed with the sheriff coming to the door and all that kind of stuff. And it just ends up being easier because the process to go through eviction is multiple steps and lots of checks written by the landlord to government officials to make that happen. And I found out that it wasn't worth it. I mean, I'm not a big-time landlord. I don't have 40 or 50 units. I rent out a duplex. And mm-hmm. I've tried to help people that were down on their luck and let them in without paying deposits and that kind of stuff. And those people stuck it to me every single time. And so I quit being a nice guy, and I will only rent to people that have their deposit and their first month's rent.
So, Jim, do you do this check where if somebody has been evicted before, you will not consider them?
Well, see, me being kind of a small-time operator, I actually do not take the time to do that. I pretty much go on my gut, and if you have employment and you have the money to pay me, I usually will check with previous landlords to see, you know, what's gone on. I'll ask for those references, but I do not spend the time to see if there's been, you know, legal evictions against people before I rent to them.
I appreciate the call. I'm going to hear from another landlord here, and then I want to talk to our guests about whether, as Jim suggests, the rules are stacked against landlords to Ann in Minneapolis. Ann, you've had some experience with this?
Yes, I've had a very similar experience to Jim in that I have more house than I need and extra rooms in my house. And I also had experience being a single mom and not having really reliable housing except through friends and family. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make rooms in my home available to other people in similar situations, but I've ended up with trouble in my home with people using illegal drugs, with people being an alcoholic and not disclosing that, and then having to deal with that. And I have kids. So similar to Jim, I've ended up finding out that very often what I have to do is just say, go. You know, you cannot engage in this behavior in my home in front of my kids. I will evict you if I have to. I do not want to. Because, like your other guest pointed out, that makes it impossible for them to find housing going forward. I don't want that to happen, but I also don't want that kind of behavior in my home. And I've also found out that from the downside of being a landlord is that when there is that illegal behavior going on, even though it's in my own home, because they have a place that is considered their own, the police will not actually do anything about it because it is their home, so they won't come in. And if I can say that they're using marijuana, it's very clear from the odor in the home, the police won't do anything about it.
And I appreciate the call. This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about eviction, and we've been talking quite a bit about the perspective from the tenant side. We've heard from some landlords who feel like they're between a rock and a hard place. What do you do when someone's not abiding by some of the rules of the place? I'll hear from Jesse McCoy and Maya Brennan on that on the other side of news. And if you've just gotten in on the show, if you've experienced eviction, could you find help? If you work in a field that tries to address the problem, what works? I mean, what do you think is actually effective to decrease the number of evictions? Because it sounds to me in the discussion, everybody wants that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Right back to your calls and questions on the other side of news to Stephen John now. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Carrie. President Trump was in Pennsylvania today to mark the September 11th terrorist attacks, and the passengers and crew members who realized their plane had been hijacked and tried to storm the cockpit. The president and First Lady Melania Trump walked to an overlook in Shanksville to view the field where a commercial airliner crashed 17 years ago today, killing all 40 people aboard. Trump addressed several hundred dignitaries and family members during a remembrance ceremony. Forecasters say Florence will arrive on land as an extremely dangerous major hurricane by the end of the week. According to the National Hurricane Center, Florence has maximum sustained winds now of nearly 130 miles an hour. Its center will move between Bermuda and the Bahamas between now and Wednesday, then approach the coast of South Carolina or North Carolina. Native American tribes in Montana and South Dakota say the Trump administration unlawfully approved the Keystone XL oil pipeline without considering potential damage to cultural sites. Attorneys for the Fort Belknap and Rosebud Sioux tribes have filed suit against the U.S. State Department, asking a court to rescind the permit. The $8 billion pipeline would carry up to 830,000 barrels of crude oil daily through the tribe's ancestral homelands. Russia today launched its largest military exercise since the Cold War. The war games will also involve thousands of Chinese troops in a show of burgeoning military ties between Moscow and Beijing amid spiraling tensions with the West. Moscow said the Vostok 2018 maneuvers will span vast expanses of Siberia and the Far East and involve nearly 300,000 Russian troops, as well as thousands of tanks, aircraft, and other military vehicles. Minnesota weather, mostly sunny, breezy, and mild today with highs mid-70s to mid-80s. There is a chance of thunderstorms in the northwest. 75 degrees in the Twin Cities at 11:36.
Programming supported by Minnesota Iron, dedicated to operating responsible, innovative iron mines, which have helped build, protect, and support our state and country for the last 130 years. Imagine life without iron. You can learn more at minnesotairon.org.
On the next NPR News Presents, a new documentary from APM Reports called Still Rising, First Generation College Students a Decade Later. Two students started community college 10 years ago. You can hear how things worked out today at noon and 9 p.m.
Hey, if you missed our show on free tuition to medical school, the upside and downside of that, or you missed the conversation I had at 9 o'clock about how political humor is evolving, you can always catch it on the podcast. There's an even easier way. If you've got a smart speaker, an Echo, an Amazon Echo, or Google Play, just tell them to play Carrie Miller's shows, and there they are for you. Let me know how it works, and you'll know now that you can catch the show anytime at your convenience. Back to the discussion now. Maya Brennan with us from the Urban Institute, where she's a senior policy associate, and Jesse McCoy with us, supervising attorney for the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic. Jesse, Maya, want to talk to you about what we heard from the landlords. Do you see that perspective? They're not abiding by the rules of the place. Maybe they're not paying on time. What's a landlord to do? Jesse?
Well, from my perspective, it's a little bit different. So I know that what was mentioned before was that they felt the tenants get the favoritism with the way that the law is currently set up. Mm-hmm. The problem I have with that is the majority of the people who instituted the laws in the first place were landlords. The majority of the people who are enforcing these laws in the first place are landlords.
I
don't know that I necessarily agree. What I will say is I think that the law is designed to be more adversarial than the process itself needs to be. And I think one of the problems is that we also have to look at the priorities from both sides. So for a tenant, their basic priority is a continuing place to stay. For a landlord, their priority is a continuing defense of their property right. So they want to be able to remove who they can remove when they need to remove. In North Carolina, the things that the prior caller was mentioning about drug use, that qualifies actually for an expedited eviction process. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even require a guilty conviction or plea. It can be as simple as an officer coming to court saying, yeah, I charged this person with possession of marijuana, and that's it. That person has to get out. So I don't know. Now, evictions are very different in different states and even enforced differently in different counties. So it may be in her area, respectfully, it could be that way. But I would say as far as North Carolina law goes, I think that it's a lot more difficult for a tenant to get any kind of standing to present their case than it would be for a landlord.
Maya, would you say that the way the laws are in many states, they are weighted in favor of the landlord? And if you agree with that, what do you do, though, as a landlord if you have somebody who, you know, is not abiding by the rules of the place or not paying on time? What's the best outcome of that?
Yeah, there's been some research that was published in Housing Policy Debate, and you can find through the How Housing Matters website that the Urban Institute runs about how different states' landlord and tenant favoritism or more balanced or contradictory approaches in landlord-tenant laws are. And so it really does vary a lot from place to place about who gets more favoritism in the system, although, as Jesse notes, it is truly a system that was built and created more for property rights purposes than for individual protection purposes. That said,
the rental system, just like a lot of sports, it requires there to be two sides here in order for anybody to win. A renter needs a landlord just like a batter needs a pitcher. And a landlord needs a renter to be able to get the funds back. So what I've really heard from Jim and Anne is this sense that some of what they're really looking for and needing is hard in the worst case scenarios. Eviction is not something that anybody really benefits from.
Right.
And they've both found ways to either work it out amicably or decide on their own to take kind of an individual mediation approach before it gets to court.
Janet says on Twitter, Hennepin County needs to increase the dollar amount in the emergency assistance. I've been in this situation, and because my rent was too high, assistance was denied, but the city would pay the deposit in the first month to an affordable place. They would only pay $800. To the phones here to Joel in Duluth. Hey, Joel, thank you so much for waiting. I know you're involved in this field.
Yeah, hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I serve on the board of directors of a neighborhood housing services nonprofit called One Roof Housing, and we actually have a program housed within us called the Tenant-Landlord Connection.
Mm-hmm.
That whole purpose is to mediate between landlords and tenants and try and prevent evictions. And, being on the board of directors, I get to see the numbers as far as who's served. And it's really those most vulnerable populations. It's quite stark seeing who is actually benefiting from it. And knowing that there's great cost occurred by everyone
right.
when evictions take place. So we get some funding from the city, from the county, and from a community foundation. But every year we have to make sure that funding's there because it's not something that people necessarily recognize up front, that value, to try and prevent those costs. But thankfully here in Duluth, we do have some people who are willing to step up and get behind it. But it's really important work that we are glad to have the opportunity to do here in Duluth.
So Joel, would you, with the mediation, would you be drawing on a fund to say to the landlord, okay, they're behind, you know, let's say 3 months' rent. Will X amount that we'll draw out of this fund satisfy you, and how do we work this out going forward? I mean, is that how it works?
We don't have funds necessarily to use to commit to that, but what we do is we sit down at the table because so often it's communication between the two parties.
Really? Okay.
About what is going on and addressing things and people not knowing their rights. So instead of showing up in court without knowing their rights, you know, or the landlord finding out that they don't have the right to do something that they try and do, we sit down at the table, let each party know about their rights and obligations, and mediate that conflict. And so it's not necessarily always about needing to bring outside resources in,
mm-hmm.
but mediating a process for bringing both parties to a place where they feel like they can move forward. And it's an ongoing thing. We see some, you know, these people often who are needing the services don't have a lot of resources themselves. So it's not like we fix the problem forever. But if we can prevent that eviction in that moment, that often saves them from having to, you know, lose additional money and resources and can help, you know, somewhat stabilize them for the future, just preventing that single eviction occurring.
Jesse, what do you think the track record is of programs like Joel has described?
Well, I will say it's very difficult because I don't know for every state kind of what their programs offer. But for our program here in Durham County, we have been successful in 79% of the cases that we've handled in avoiding an eviction judgment.
Wow.
And within that, about 67% of the cases that we've handled, we were actually able to keep the tenant in the unit. So it's very important. I usually think that the best results that we get are typically from people who come to us as early in the process as possible so that we can have time to talk to the landlord before they expend the costs associated with litigation. I also want to emphasize, too, you know, we heard from some landlords about their particular concerns, but mm-hmm. landlords are not a monolith. So there are some small landlords, mom and pop operations that are very good, that do a lot of good work to establish, I guess, the degree of affordable housing supply that we have at this point. But what the big elephant in the room is that there's just a large there's a large need for additional affordable housing.
For sure.
And what we're also dealing with is landlords who may be corporate landlords who are not housed within our state and who are not familiar with the dynamics at play, but are taking advantage of a system where supply is low and demand is high and are able to charge a higher market rent.
This is, I'm glad you brought this up because, Maya, I was curious about whether you think this is a problem of rising rents and an economy where wages have been stagnant for many years and the have and the have-nots, there's a greater gap. Or is it really more about this lack of affordable housing in so many cities, including here in Minneapolis-St. Paul?
The roots of the problem are manifold. So there are risks that are just straight built into the housing system in not having the amount of rental housing to match the amount of renters. After the mortgage crisis, as more people moved from homeownership into renting, and as homeowners, prospective homeowners, delayed their purchase, we had a growth of high-income renters entering a market where there still wasn't very much being built. And so the rents rose. Folks who were at the bottom got squeezed even more. And sometimes what that did was lead to more eviction. Sometimes what that did was lead to more homelessness or lead to people doubling up. But in Washington, D.C., interestingly enough, the legal aid providers found that they were seeing fewer evictions as the rent started to rise in the city because the city was no longer actually a place where a low-income person, a single mom with kids, could find a place to rent.
They were forcing lower-income renters out of the city,
right?
Which is why they were seeing fewer evictions. If you've just tuned in, it's a conversation about understanding why there's an epidemic of eviction going on, and specifically from our guests, what we know works to try to interrupt that cycle. Jesse McCoy with us from the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic and Maya Brennan with us from the Urban Institute. And by the way, if you joined the show late, it's been a lot of good perspective from our callers. You can find it on the podcast or you can just tell your smart speaker to stream it. Worth a listen if you're interested in the topic. To Julie in Minneapolis. Hi, Julie. Hey, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hello. I grew up with a single mom, and we moved about 11 times from eviction.
Wow.
And the part that I wanted to say was the emotional turmoil that it caused, especially with my mom. She was a more fragile person, and, you know, it pushed her over the edge. And I would worry so much that she would take her life, I would stay home from school.
Oh, Julie. I'm sure that was incredibly disruptive, not just to her, but to you too.
Right. And I think the part that I wanted to say now, because I know in the cities there's more resources, but I know in rural areas there's less, but I think there's been a shift towards criminalizing and pathologizing working poor or just poor people. And if we actually were honest about how many people have a hard time making it, it should be easier. We should find a way to make it where people can have their dignity and work and not have to go through so many traumas to just keep housing, safe housing.
Jesse, is that what you find, what Julie describes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are a number of collateral consequences. So we've talked about the immediacy of being unable to attain housing. But I would also guess that from those additional moves, you're talking about disruption of your kid's school. You're talking about things that where you're going to have a lower stock of housing that you're going to be able to access, which oftentimes is not going to be the highest quality of housing that you would otherwise be entitled to, but for that eviction. And because of all of these different collateral consequences, there really does need to be a mechanism in place to address the number of people who are being churned out because of evictions. Part of the process of our clinic is to stop the rubber stamp process of evictions. Mm-hmm. So often you go to court, there may not be a tenant because they couldn't get a day off of work or they couldn't find childcare or whatever the case may be. Those turn into evictions. And oftentimes, because the court is so flooded with these cases, there may not even be a legitimate trial process where people are able to discuss these issues. It may just be landlord presents a ledger, shows there's a deficit. That's all that the court wants. And they institute a rubber stamp on evictions. And we view evictions as a cause of homelessness and a cause of poverty. I don't know that the national standard has necessarily subscribed to that opinion, but our job is trying to reduce the impact of those judgments and reduce the number of those judgments for that main purpose.
Yeah, I mean, you sound like you agree with what Matthew Desmond says, that it's not a symptom of poverty, it's a source of poverty.
Correct. Absolutely.
Maya, what do you think of the Kamala Harris and the Cory Booker bills, which would, just to kind of pare it down here, they'd provide money to families who are spending a certain percentage of their income on rent. They'd have sliding scales, but it's direct assistance. Do you think this is an effective way to try to interrupt these cycles?
Well, the nation desperately needs more affordable housing. It needs it through every possible mechanism. There's been bipartisan support in the past through a bipartisan housing commission for universal assistance for families who are earning wages that are around the poverty level. The Booker and Harris bills are other approaches to add more funding into the system. There's been some analysis by groups like the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and Turner Center and folks at the Urban Institute of what some of the right mechanisms would be. But basically what we know is that the cost of these bills, the estimated cost of these bills, is pretty similar to what the U.S. government pays in mortgage interest deductions for homeowners, providing.
You mean the tax credit?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And as anyone who's a homeowner doesn't have to wait on a waiting list, doesn't have to prove that they're income eligible, doesn't get shame and scorn for accepting assistance. They just plain get that money.
And it's expected.
I mean, right.
You know what the debate sounds like when they try to take that away, right? The mortgage interest
exactly.
deduction. A good question here from Jeff in Minneapolis. Hi, Jeff. Your query on this.
Yes, I just, it's a great program. Thank you. I listen to NPR quite a bit. Just
Thank
quick
you.
Throw that in there.
Thanks.
Me and my wife had rented a place in Minneapolis. The pipes had frozen in the winter. The landlord brought over a bullet heater, put it in the basement. Then he took it back, and the pipes just kept freezing. Mm. So we put our money in escrow. We found a spot. It was over off Lindale Lake in the bottom of a church. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. And renters, it was something for renters, and we searched it out and found it.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, when we went there and put our money in escrow, the gentleman that helped us said, oh, this gentleman, who I won't say his name, I have had so many, for years, I've had complaints about him. He's a slumlord. And my question is, what does the state do about landlords like that? Because I know there's a lot of great landlords we've rented before, but I now own a home with two boys. I'm just curious of what they do with landlords who don't take care of their properties and allow things like that to happen and years go on.
Yeah,
but I'll take my answer off here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Jesse, what do they do in North Carolina to help people steer clear of infamous, or I should say notorious, landlords?
That is a very good question. So in North Carolina, what happens is a lot of people don't tend to report these issues to the county, but the place to start whenever you're looking at a potential residence is with the county's inspection service. We have an inspection service that will allow you to backtrack up to 10 years of inspection records for a particular address to see if there's been anything done. The county has their own process for if there's three failed inspections within the time period when that same file is open. They can institute a criminal action against the landlord in what's called community life court mm-hmm. here. But it doesn't happen often. And I would I would guess that the reason that it doesn't happen often is because we're dealing with, in the housing market, just a system based solely on supply and demand and the private ownership of housing, so that when people put up their housing as quote unquote affordable, the county has a vested interest in ensuring that those affordable housing units are filled. And because of that, they're very hesitant to bring any sharp penalty against the landlord without a lot of communication regarding violations and subsequent clients and whatnot. So I would be inclined to believe that on a national scale, it's probably very similar.
You know, Maya, before we go, we've done a number of shows on affordable housing, but the takeaway for me from those conversations is the action on addressing it is really happening at the city and, you know, secondarily at the state level. And Congress is doing nothing about it. I mean, Congress just seems, you know, short of these bills that have been introduced, which will probably go nowhere, Congress just seems pretty ignorant of the scale of the problem. Correct me if that's not true, if there's more going on than I know.
Well, this past budget cycle, the budget for major assistance programs from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development did better than a lot of people expected. So we are getting basically some help treading water from Congress, but not actually getting to the point of solutions. A lot of the work happening in solutions is happening at the local and the state level. Affordable housing has become one of the major issues that people are bringing to their mayors, because we see that a home can and should be a refuge and a safe place and a platform for growth. And it is not at this point for far too many people.
I mean, the dilemma with that, Jesse, that's all good. But, you know, the dilemma with that is that cities have limited budgets and states have a lot of priority. It's hard to take maybe the size of the investment that's needed. Maybe North Carolina is doing something about that. I don't know.
Well, in North Carolina, I think that we haven't necessarily gotten a lot of state action on these programs. We've had a lot of success in the city and county level in trying to allocate more resources. We've expanded the number of attorneys that are part of the eviction diversion program. And there's anticipation that we're also going to be expanding the amount of money that is provided through the social services agencies for rental assistance. But there are so many different issues that need to be addressed, one being that right to counsel. We don't have that in North Carolina, unlike some states, but we know that having an attorney will provide a greater impact for tenants to be able to prevent evictions in about 88% of the cases.
Jesse and Maya, thanks so much. Thanks for the work and the insight on in the conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
And if you missed the show, you can find it on the podcast, or you can find it in Google or Amazon Play.